Hello, and welcome to episode 26, our anniversary episode for this podcast we've titled Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, how's things, Perry? I don't think either of us thought we'd get through a year of this.
Absolutely not. I'm not terribly sure we thought we'd get through 26 episodes of this podcast, and I'm not terribly sure I thought I'd get through 5 or 6 weeks of COVID-19 lock-in, but here we are.
Here we are.
At that point, my house is completely crowded at the moment with everybody in the house today. So
that's all right. Well, if there's a little noise in the background, that'll be fine. The listeners will understand.
Well, hopefully the bloke next door won't start up with his leaf blower. He normally does that on a Sunday, okay. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, but all birds are alike these days.
He's actually going to work each day, so that makes things a little bit easier. I've booted my daughter out of her room, so I've got that, and everybody else has got their own rooms, and I think my daughter's going to have a sleep down the back, so that'll make things a lot easier for all of us.
Uh-huh.
But there have been a few, other than the fact that this is our anniversary podcast episode, there have been a few things happen in the Australian SF world over the last couple of weeks, David.
Yes, I think we should acknowledge the passing of Mervyn Binns, who was a stalwart of certainly of the Melbourne science fiction community and a very important figure really in Australian science fiction fandom over the many years. He established the Melbourne Science Fiction Club way back when, I think in the 50s. He set up his own. He used to work in McGill's news agency, which is like a big bookstore and news agency. And he was like in charge of the science fiction counter there. And a lot of things came out of that. Australian Science Fiction Review fanzine was one of the things that was on the counter at McGill's because of Merv. And eventually Merv set out on his own and established Space Age Books, which was a premier science fiction-oriented bookstore in Melbourne for many years and a very important part of the science fiction community here. So it's very sad to see Merv go. His passing wasn't to do with COVID-19, but he'd had some serious cardiac problems prior to that, and I think he was 86 when he passed a couple of weeks ago.
So somewhere around that age, yeah.
So we should just acknowledge that that's happened. That's rather sad.
Yes, it is. He was, as you said, he was a major part of fandom in Australia and specifically in Melbourne, where he helped set up the Melbourne Science Fiction Club and was a main conduit for information about science fiction passing through Melbourne. I remember visiting Space Age Books, which I'd heard about. The first time I ever visited it was in January 1975, and it was there that I bought a couple of fanzines and a few things because I was going on holiday into Tasmania. And I also was able to pick up membership forms for AussieCon in 1975. So in some ways, Merv, in all the best possible ways, has a lot to answer for in terms of science fiction fandom in Australia. But it's good things that he has to answer for.
Indeed.
And his legacy will carry on. He picked up a number of major awards in the science fiction field for his work for science fiction fandom and science fiction in general in Australia, and he'll be greatly missed by a large number of people across the whole gamut of science fiction fandom in Australia and also overseas.
Indeed.
Because a number of people that came to AussieCon and AussieCon 2 while Space Age Books was still extant will remember him and remember him fondly. So he will be greatly missed.
Indeed. All right, well, this being our anniversary episode, we decided to do something a little bit different. And rather than talk about the books we've been reading recently, we thought we'd pick 5 books which are kind of our favourites of all time. They're in different categories, but so we've each picked a group of 5 books. The categories don't always mesh, but that doesn't really matter. But the first category was going to be science fiction. So Perry, do you want to lead off and talk about your favourite SF book?
I will. Just a couple of things that I want to mention beforehand. I actually decided to go back and try and reread as many of these as I could. I got through 4 of the 5. Some of them I hadn't read for 30 years. some that I'd read, well, within the last 10 years. But there's always a big problem, David, when you come to rereading favourite books. You're always a little bit worried. There's always that little guy at the back of your head that says, is it this time? Is it this time that you read it that you're absolutely going to look at this book and go, what the hell did I ever see in this? The science fiction writer Joe Walton refers to this as the book being visited by the suck fairy. In other words, now, once the book was great, it was absolutely tremendous, it rocked your world, but now it just sucks. So I was lucky with my set of books in that I read them with a slight sense of trepidation and that I didn't really want to have that feeling come over me that I really didn't like it after all. But four of the five, pretty good. One of them, which I'll get to, has got a little bit of, yeah, maybe not quite as good as I thought it was way back when, but we'll get to that.
Fair enough.
But my first book is The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. This is undoubtedly my favourite SF novel. I think it may well have been the first novel by Le Guin's that I read, and I probably would have read it in the lead up to Aussiecon 2, so sometime in the early to mid 70s, first time. I've probably read it four, five times since, and having read it less than 2 weeks ago, Suck Fairy didn't go anywhere in this one, near this one, David. This one's a cracker. It is really, really good. Now, I know that you've got different views about this, which we'll get to a bit later on, but bear with me. Now, this was only the second novel in the science fiction field to win both the major SF awards, namely the Hugo and Nebula. The previous one that had won it was Dune by Frank Herbert. Another classic in the film. But Le Guin was the first woman to win it twice, and she became the first person to win both of them twice when she won in 1975 with The Dispossessed. Now, The Dispossessed is set in the same universe as The Left Hand of Darkness, but set in that universe sometime before. There's only one minor little connection between The Dispossessed and this one, but it carries the whole of the background. Now, the background to this set of novels that Le Guin wrote, and there was probably seven or eight in the series, somewhere around that, not entirely sure. It's called the Hainish Cycle. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, Hainish or Harnish, or I'm going to pronounce it Hainish. And this is number four in the Hainish Cycle. Now, the background of this is that at some time 100,000 years prior to this particular book, the Hain, a humanoid alien race, seeded a large number of inhabitable worlds in this part of the galaxy with humanoid species. Now, in this particular book, which I hadn't remembered previously, but in this particular book, one of the characters, probably the main character, makes a point that he thinks that the Hain used the seeding of these particular planets as a means of undertaking a series of genetic experiments. In one of the particular planets, which was visited in one of the earlier books, I believe the humanoid species is winged, that is, has wings. The Earth, which is one of the species, which is one of the planets that has been seeded, I'm not sure what the genetic mutation there is, but as you go along, you sort of get the impression, if you think about it, that it was probably that a number of different race colours were included. On this particular planet that we're dealing with here, which is called Gethin or Winter, the genetic mutation is that the race is androgynous. At any time during a year or any time during their life, adults on this particular planet can and do morph into either male or female forms. It is quite possible for them to become pregnant it is also possible for them at a later time to actually sire children. In other words, they can be either the male or female side of the relationship. And in one particular relationship, they can move from one to the other. They could have a lifelong bond and be both male and female sides of this. Now, this is a very, very interesting setup in the background because it changes completely the way that the inhabitants of this planet see themselves and see other people. Now, this particular book, I think, is one of the first ones where she does this, where included in the background, you have the seeding of all these planets in the background, but from Earth has become this commonwealth of planets called the Ecumen. The Ecumen attempt to, when they find a new planet with seeded humanoid species in it, on it, attempt to bring that planet into the Commonwealth. Now, this is not an empire where you have somebody at the top telling everybody what to do. This is more a Commonwealth of planets, a bit like the British Commonwealth, in that they basically interact with each other on a cultural or economic or trade basis, but that's it. Nobody has overriding power over everything. And in fact, it's in a science fiction series where you don't have faster than light travel. You only have nearly as fast as light travel. That's about the only way that you can really run things. Now, the way that the Ecumen get each planet to come into the fold, if you like, is that they first send in a series of observers, because of course everybody's sort of humanoid-like, so they can put people that look like the natives of the particular planet onto the planet, do the investigation. A short time later, they send down one particular person who is referred to as a mobile. That mobile then basically makes themselves known as being from the Ecumen and invites a particular government from any one nation that they've chosen to come into the fold. The idea being that you start with one and then you move to the other governments afterwards. Now, there's a note in here that there are 84 members of the Ecumen. Now, I'm not sure whether that's 84 planets or 84 governments or nations on different planets. But anyway, there are 84 members of this intergalactic United Nations, for want of a better term. Anyway, so the main character's name in this is generally I, and his main contact on this particular planet is a character called Estravan. Now, there are two main countries on this particular planet. There is Karhide, which is a monarchy, and Orgorian, which is sort of a commune, not quite communist, but sort of a commune style of government. These are the two major governments, countries in this particular on this particular planet, and they don't like each other and don't get along with each other terribly well. Generally, I lands in Karhide and attempts to get the king, the monarch, Argovan, to see his point of view and see his way of basically joining up with the Ecumen. But Argovan is a bit mad, unfortunately, and doesn't see the benefit, and really makes it very difficult for generally I to get his point across. What ends up happening is the book is that generally I is sort of, he moves from one country to another. The other country is also in the same boat. They don't really want to know about him. In fact, they have a lot of people that actively say that what he's talking about is a load of garbage and there's no such thing as other planets. And they actually lock him up. Estravan has been ostracized by his king, because he was previously prime minister, so he's a fair way up in the government. He's been ostracized and he's now in the same country as well. And he rescues generally I from the prison camp, and they undertake a long walk across the ice over the top of the world from one country into another. Now, the whole thing about this book is that it's It's just a wonderful exploration of an alien society that is only slightly alien. It's humanoid and human in very many aspects, but it's got enough of a difference in it in the society that it's very, very different from the one that generally I is used to. See, generally is permanently male. The people that he's dealing with at any time, once a month, could be either neuter for the most of the time, or then become male, or become female. And Estraven actually has a problem when he's dealing with generally I, in that because I is so predominantly male, that Estraven finds himself continuously, while he was with him, when he gets into that period of time when he might be coming on to the time when he might mate with somebody, is actually finding himself being pushed continuously into being female. And he's trying not to stay away from that, to basically have a point where he's just being able to communicate with generally I on a standard level. There's so many things about this particular book that is deep all the way right through. There's brilliant explanations of the sexuality of people, the problems associated with accepting that a emissary from an alien race has come down to your world and telling you that, well, it's up to you. But why didn't you come down in large numbers? No, we find it's a lot easier. You're not going to get scared of just one person. And the view is that if that first mobile doesn't succeed and either dies or is executed or killed in some way on the planet, the Ekumen sends another one and another one. And another one, and they keep doing it until the country decides they keep on sending these guys and they keep on saying the same stuff. There's a fairly good chance that maybe they're right. But there's brilliant explanations here and discussions about the light, the dark, the colours, in terms of what how the shadows and lights basically go against each other all the way right through. Now, I don't normally quote from books when I actually review them, but I think in this instance it's probably a good idea because the title is fairly evocative. It says a very large amount about the book, but you don't realise it until you're most of the way through. And the title comes from a poem from the country that generally I is visiting. And the poem goes, "Light is the left hand of darkness, and darkness the right hand of light. Two are one, life and death, lying together like lovers in Khmer, like hands joined together, like the end and the way." Now, Khmer is the state that inhabitants of this world get into when they become either male or female in that part of the month. I would have been very interested to ask the Gwyn if she had written that poem first or wrote it last, or wrote it while she was writing the book, because I think just about everything in the book is encapsulated in that particular poem in about six lines, and it's all there. This is a cracker of a book. I would hardly recommend that anybody in the field who knows anything about the field and wants to know anything about the field should basically have read this book at some point or other.
Indeed. Yeah, that's it is a great book. I won't make really any comment on that. Just one thing perhaps to add to what you've said is the lovely legends that she inserts every so often, that she inserts a story or a legend from the past of this world, which each of which illustrates the fact that they have this gender, very different gender setup than we do on Earth. And so that's a very nice feature of the book too. All right, well, I might roll on to my first book. This is also science fiction, so we try to put them roughly together in categories. And this is a book called The Stars, My Destination by Alfred Bester, which was written in, I think, 1961, something like that. And this may not be the best science fiction novel I've ever read, but to me it's the most memorable. Compared to the works of Ursula Le Guin, this book is a technicolor extravaganza in which we're hooked by an obsessive quest for vengeance pursued by its unforgettable protagonist, Gelly Foyle. I first read this book in my teens in its serial form in Galaxy magazine with beautiful, wonderful illustrations by Ed Emshwiller. I think I've mentioned before on this podcast that I kind of inherited a great stack of pulp SF magazines of the 1950s and 60s from the parents of a school friend who were going overseas and had to leave them behind. So there's a whole lot of galaxies, lots of IF magazine and so on. Anyway, that's where I first read this novel, which stood out for me from all of the other novels in serial form that I'd encountered in those magazines. So this is the setup. We're in the 25th century and the solar system has been explored and pretty much inhabited everywhere. All the moons of the outer planets are inhabited. But there are increasing tensions between the outer planets and the inner planets, which seem likely to lead to a war in the near future. And so far, that's pretty ordinary. Nothing very extraordinary about that kind of setup. But the twist which Besser introduces is the development among humans of the power to teleport themselves by an act of will. They can jump instantly from one location to another. It's like a psychic power, which until then was latent in humanity. It was discovered by accident, but this ability is called jaunting after its discoverer, Dr. Jaunt, who first leapt from one place to another when his clothes caught fire in a laboratory. And in desperation, he jaunts from one place to another to get to a fire extinguisher. So anyway, the ability to do this jaunting varies between individuals, but can be trained up to be better. And the distance that one can jump depends on the person's ability. Some people can only do a few kilometres, some thousands. But so far, no one has been able to jaunt in space or through space, only on the surface of a body like the Earth. And attempts to jump from the Earth to the Moon or between spacecraft all fail, and the person attempting it is never seen again. They just vanish. And this new ability has forced many changes in society. For example, because the person jaunting must know the exact coordinates of both departure and destination, or be able to visualize them, labyrinths are used at banks and in private residences to defeat casual intrusions, because once you've walked through the labyrinth, you're not going to know exactly where you are or which direction you're facing. So you can't simply jaunt into a place you've been before. Against this background, which is pretty interesting in itself, we're introduced to Gully Foyle, who is the sole survivor on board a spacecraft which has been almost totally destroyed. I think it's somewhere in between Mars and Jupiter at the time. So perhaps it's been destroyed by a collision with a space rock, like a little asteroid or something. And he's been stuck there for quite some time in the only remaining airtight space, which is a tool locker. Periodically, he has to venture out for supplies, including air tanks. And so the first chapter begins, "He was 170 days dying and not yet dead." Anyway, on one of his desperate supply expeditions, he spots another spacecraft coming near, a sister ship to his own, which is his ship is the SS Nomad. Anyway, he sets off a series of distress flares. But nevertheless, despite having obviously seen these flares, because it kind of pulls to a halt or something like that, the other ship that's clearly seen these flares passes him by and leaves him. And so this drives him into a state of utter fury at being deserted this way, and it shakes him out of his listless state. And with this kind of white hot anger, he sets about trying to escape his predicament. He does manage to get back to Earth, but on the way he's captured by a group of savages on an asteroid who tattoo his face with a Maori-like tiger mask. So he has all these wills and swirls on his face. Wills and swirls? Well, you know what I mean. He escapes from them too, but the tattooing remains and kind of permanently marks him out. So this almost insane lust for vengeance on the part of Gully Foyle drives the whole plot of the book. And he's not a nice man. In pursuit of his vengeance, he commits murder, he commits rape. Only towards the end of the book do we see him start to regret this destructive path and to try to make amends, by which time it is really too late. As I say, it's kind of a technicolor sort of book. It's full of vivid images and extraordinary events and places. There's some unlikely things, like the sudden sexual passion which springs up between Foyle and Olivia Prestain, the daughter of the most powerful man on the planet, who is the owner of the SS Vorga, the ship that passed him by. I thought there were some interesting connections with classic literature. The book's prologue begins with what's surely a deliberate echo of Dickens's Tale of Two Cities. Starts, "This was a golden age, a time of high adventure, rich living and hard dying, but nobody thought so. This was a future of fortune and theft, pillage and rapine, culture and vice, but nobody admitted it. This was an age of extremes, a fascinating century of freaks, but nobody loved it." And Foyle's story itself, this whole arc of the search for vengeance, has many similarities with The Count of Monte Cristo, I thought. But in general, the style is certainly not a literary style. It's well enough written, but it's not literary in any sort of way. It's the story and the character of Gully Foyle which drives it forward. It's true that the perfect time to read this book is in your teens, which is when I first read it. But having just reread it in my 60s, I can say that it still holds up pretty well, I thought. Have you read this book, Perry?
A long time ago. It's one of those ones that I'm going to have to get back to. I read The Demolished Man a little while back and I struggled with that one. But I'm quite willing to give Stars My Destination a go. It's one of those books that, like Left Hand of Darkness, is considered to be one of the classics in the field. Another one that people should basically know something about, even if they don't like it. That's probably
yeah,
oh, best.
Indeed, yeah.
It's best that they've read it to see where a number of later threads in the science fiction field come from. Because some of the ones that we're talking about here, both Le Guin and Bester, were masters in the field that set up things that have carried on for decades afterwards. The difficulty that you've got at times reading them out of their chronological time period in which they were written is you can read them and come to the conclusion that, well, this is a bit cliched. Well, it's not a cliche if it was done the very first time.
Well, that's
and
true.
So this stuff may well have been the first time that a lot of this stuff was ever done. And I'm pretty certain there wasn't very much stuff done before Le Guin did that. And there's a lot of things that Bester did in this book and in others that were never done before, or certainly never done that way.
No.
And he stood out from the general ruck of those white middle-class males that were writing science fiction in the 50s and 60s. Absolutely.
Yeah. I did think what I ought to say, too, is that the way I've chosen these books is really not so much to choose the best, because certainly, as I say, I don't think you'd consider the Stars My Destination necessarily the best science fiction ever written. But the way I chose these books was it's a book I've read more than once already, and it's a book which I would look forward to reading again. And that's certainly true of all the books I've chosen.
Yeah, I'd agree with that as well. The same thing here.
Yeah.
These are ones that I've read multiple times, really enjoyed, and are my favourites. And all we're trying to do is give an explanation as to why they are our favourites, but somebody else's mileage may vary.
Oh, quite likely.
Their view may be completely different.
Indeed.
And people are going to struggle with some of these books that we have here and go, what the hell is he talking about? We're talking about this book. But it's important to us.
Sure.
I think that I should also mention that I'm not sure who came up with the idea for this, but part of it was that you were involved in a Twitter conversation about, I think it was the heading, if I remember rightly, if you want to know who I am, here are the 10 books that you need to be aware of.
Yes.
Which sort of make me the person that I am.
Mm.
And I think that we took that and sort of said, well, let's not do 10 because that's a fair number. Let's do 5 and let's talk about our favourite 5 books.
Yeah.
And as it happened, we've got some that are similar and there's no crossovers.
Yeah.
But we have read some of the others' books. You've read more of mine than I think you've read four of mine. And I've read 3 of yours. And
something like that.
One of them you're going to castigate me for not having read, and
I'm fully
aware that that's going to happen, and I'm fully aware that I'm going to have to take that. The interesting thing is that book is sitting on my shelf, but anyway.
All right. Okay, well, let's go from here. So do you want to do your next one?
You're right. Well, my next one's a non-fiction work. It's called The Hero with 1,000 Faces from 1949. By a gentleman by the name of Joseph Campbell. Now, this is a work of comparative mythology which gained a lot of traction in the 1980s when it was revealed that George Lucas of Star Wars fame was a big fan of this book. I've since discovered that Stanley Kubrick was also a fan of this book and introduced Arthur C. Clarke to it when they were making the 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, this is a book that focuses on the commonality of mythologies around the world. And in particular, it focuses on what's referred to as the hero's journey. Now, there's a fairly interesting and succinct quote here from Campbell in the book, which defines what he's actually talking about. And he rabbits on a fair bit about a whole lot of stuff, but this is probably the best one.
Rabbits on, yes, go on.
A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. Now, Campbell takes the point that this is the overall structure of a lot of hero tales in mythology, but also standard stories of hero quests in literature. Now, Campbell, in The Hero's Journey, discusses in the book 17 different stages that a hero goes through. First one being the call to adventure, namely, there's a reason why the hero has to undertake the adventure in the first part, but there's a possibility that the hero could accept the call to adventure, or he could reject it. Now, Campbell is only ever using the male pronoun here because that was at the time that he was writing it, that it was basically all readers were he, and so we have to put up with the fact that we're dealing with Campbell talking in his time in the late 40s. So when he refers to heroes, he refers to the heroes as he all the time, whereas we know that we really need a better pronoun that covers both of them, David. And this goes back to Left Out of Darkness, where I should have mentioned things about pronouns that Le Guin was unhappy that she later on only ever used the male pronoun. But again, from the time in which she wrote that, the male pronoun was the one. Anyway, basically, the whole idea with a hero's journey is that the hero starts out on the journey and then travels through a threshold where they get help from somebody, magical being, a mentor, an old guy. They then undertake a large number of tests. They have to undergo a flight somewhere or other and overcome obstacles. And then they hit a major obstacle which they have to overcome, which is the final threshold. And once they pass that, they become the hero and then return to the world from which they came to bestow the gifts that they have discovered along the way. Now, you might think, well, that's pretty simplistic, but have a think of Lord of the Rings, for example. Frodo has a call to adventure when Gandalf, who is the big mentor, the classic aging wizard who comes along and says, well, I can help you along, calls him to the adventure. He has to accept it at the circle where they all get together and they all decide that the fellowship is going to take the ring to Mordor. The quest itself is to take something that he has got that he has to destroy, and he has to overcome a large number of different obstacles along the way. And as he goes, he changes from what he was to what he gradually becomes until he gets right to the very end and he has to undertake that final problem, that final battle, where in this case it's with Smeagol, Gollum, that he has to basically overcome that. Now, as it happens, as we know, Gollum is the one that basically ends up falling and falling into the fires of Mordor with the ring. I don't think I'm giving anything away here. Not some spoilers. I think everybody knows about this one. And then, of course, Sam and Frodo have to come back. Now, they do come back, but the odd thing about this one is that Frodo doesn't go back to the Shire because he's changed so much that he feels that he can't. But in some ways, Sam then becomes the hero and goes back. He is completely changed, and then he helps the Shire change afterwards. As you can see, it's going to happen because of what he learnt on his adventure. Now, you can say this is a simplistic approach to doing it, but Campbell has taken a very large amount of research and put it all together into this particular flow. And it gives you an understanding of how mythology works. When I first read this 30-odd years ago, I thought it flowed pretty well and I really enjoyed it. When I started reading it this time, I thought, oh my God, this is so slow. How are we going to get anywhere? And then I was thinking about that quote about the suck fairy and I thought, ooh, have I got this one? Have I hit this one? Is this the one which I'm really going to hate? Well, when I first read it 30 years ago, I thought it was absolutely stunning, absolutely fantastic. Something that I'd never read before. Thought it was tremendous in terms of the way that it held together. This time, I still think it's very good in terms of the way it's done. But to me, it reads like an academic work, which it actually is.
Sure.
And if you take it as that, once I got over that first bit of thinking, oh, God, this is turgid. He's just going on and on and on. Why doesn't he just get to the point? And I realised he was getting to the point from an academic point of view because he was building a case for what he was trying to deliver. And in order to do that, he had to put his research into it. So from that perspective, it can be dry and difficult. It's over 400 pages. It's a bit of a tough read, but it's very, very worthwhile getting into it and reading it at some point. Probably better to dip into it every now and again rather than sit down like I did and try and read it in all one big slab. If you do that, you may struggle a bit. Dipping into it is probably a better go, but it's still good. It's still up there with my top five, I think.
Indeed. If you think he's long-winded in that, you should try his four-volume Masks of God.
I haven't got work, to that.
Which I have read, indeed, but a long time ago. Yeah, a long time ago.
Oh, crikey. you're a better man than I am regarding that, then.
All right. Well, I'm going to move on to a work which isn't nonfiction, but I think it's interesting giving you talking about the hero's journey, because I think a lot of this applies to Lyra, the main character in the books by Philip Pullman, which is a trilogy called His Dark Materials, which is actually a quote from Paradise Lost, by the way, out of a quote from Paradise Lost. So I say it's a trilogy. It begins with a book called, in England it was called Northern Lights, but it was titled as The Golden Compass in the United States, which I actually think is a better title, but there you go. It begins at a place called Jordan College in Oxford, in what seems to be kind of modern day in a way, but we quickly discover that it's an Oxford in a rather different world than ours. We're introduced to Lyra Balacqua, a young girl who's accompanied by her demon, Pantalaimon, a small furry animal. What is a demon? This is spelled D-A-E, by the way, or a diphthong, daemon, demon. What is a demon? It turns out that in this world, every human being is accompanied by what you might call a spirit animal, a physical manifestation of a Jungian concept of a person having an animus or anima, depending on the gender of the person. While the human is a child, the demon can change its physical form into different kinds of animal. But when the human passes as adolescence, it settles down into some fixed sort of form, but always as some kind of animal. The human and the demon can't be physically separated by more than a few meters without it causing extreme pain to both of them. Anyway, this is all a quite extraordinary concept, and Pullman takes it in some very interesting places, I thought, but pulls it off brilliantly. It makes it very, very believable. So at the start of Northern Lights, Lyra and Pantalaimon, they're playing. She's hiding from the adults in the college. She wants to see a particular location inside the college. And so they're hiding. And while they're hiding, they witness an attempt to poison someone called Lord Azrael, who we found out is her uncle. Azrael has been in the Arctic region observing a mysterious phenomenon he calls dust, which seems to be associated with the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. And he's convinced that this phenomenon indicates that other worlds exist and that they can interpenetrate with his world. But his work is very controversial and it's opposed by the church, And here it's a much more totalitarian entity than our own Catholic Church, and much more in control of the world, the whole of the world. Hence this attempt to poison him. Anyway, shortly thereafter, Lyra is introduced to a woman called Mrs. Coulter, whose demon is a golden monkey. Lyra, it seems, had been left by her uncle, Lord Asriel, in the care of Jordan College at Oxford when she was only a babe in arms. So he's left her with them to look after him, after her. Now Mrs. Coulter, who's a charming socialite, wants to adopt Lyra. Puzzled, Lyra agrees to this. But before she leaves the college, however, the master there gives her a strange device called an alethiometer. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. An alethiometer, which is the golden compass of the US title of the book. And this enables adepts like Lyra to discover hidden information through the manipulation of little controls and setting them different symbols. However, before she can go off to live with Mrs. Coulter, Lyra's friend Roger is kidnapped by a mysterious group called the Gobblers. And Lyra is determined to find him and rescue him. So she enlists the aid of the Egyptians, who are barge dwellers, who take her north with them as they try to rescue some of their own children who've also been kidnapped by the Gobblers. And as on that journey, she also discovers that Lord Asriel and Mrs. Coulter are in fact her real parents. And intriguingly for a young adult book, as the series goes on, we eventually find out that both of Lyra's parents are really quite evil people, or at least ruthless people. Anyway, in the north, Lyra eventually meets up with not only witches, but with an intelligent talking polar bear, Iorek Bernison, who has fallen on hard times. He's getting drunk and has lost his armor, which he normally wears. And Lyra helps him regain this lost armor. And with his help and that of the Egyptians, she discovers what's happened to Roger and the other kidnapped children, who are being subjected to cruel experiments. I won't go into detail. They free the children and flee. And later, after escaping by a hot air balloon, Lyra helps the polar bear, Iorek, to regain his place as king of the bears on the island of Svalbard. And so it's really gripping stuff, really continued in the next book in the series, which is titled The Subtle Knife, in which we meet Will, who lives in a suburb in our own world. And although he's only 12, he's been looking after his mentally ill mother all by himself. His father was an Arctic explorer who disappeared many years ago. Someone breaks into Will's house, and it appears that they're trying to get hold of the explorer's journals. Will accidentally kills the intruder by tripping them, and they fall downstairs. He doesn't really mean to kill them, but he kills them that way, and then he flees his home, fearing that he's going to be put in jail as a murderer. Anyway, eventually, on this journey, he finds his way into another world through some sort of portal, where he becomes possessed of the subtle knife, which can cut portals between worlds. And at length he meets up with Lyra, who can see that Will's demon that he didn't know about is a cat. Now, for a children's author, Pullman deals with some very confronting concepts, like the mental illness of Will's mother, and in general the subjects of pain, loss and death. In the third book, The Amber Spyglass, Lyra and Will travel to the land of the dead and are forced to tear themselves away from their demons. The books also feature a considerable challenge to organized religion. There can't be many books for young people in which the Ancient of Days, or God if you like, in which the Ancient of Days dies, and in which the establishment of the Republic of Heaven is proposed. It's great stuff. I'm currently reading Pullman's follow-up to this trilogy, which is a new trilogy called The Book of Dust, of which only the first two books are out as yet, but I'm looking forward to that and looking forward to going back and starting at the beginning of the first trilogy too. So there we go.
It's an astounding piece of work. It really is.
Yeah.
I found a few of the scenes in this very emotionally disturbing, especially because I read it at a time when my children were a similar age to the children in this particular book. And if anybody ever wants to say that young adult literature isn't worthwhile reading, this and another one, which I'll mention later on, another one by Gwen later on, if they should read this particular series and then come back to me and say that it wasn't worthwhile reading. And it wasn't beautifully written and as good an adult, as good a novel as you're ever going to find anywhere in any genre.
Yeah. Well, I think, in fact, that Pullman said that he didn't write them with any particular audience in mind. He didn't necessarily write them for young people, but it's obviously it does appeal to young people at that particular time of their lives. So,
I think it was probably marketed as YA literature in the first instance.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But you know, it goes. It's good for all people to basically be able to read this, and everybody should actually get to it and read it at some point.
Absolutely, yeah. It certainly doesn't pull any punches. All right, what you got next?
I'm going to make a very strange move to an old favourite of mine. The book is called The Tango Briefing by Adam Hall from 1973. It's a weird book because it's classic British intelligence espionage novel. It's the complete antithesis of the James Bond secret agent that we know. This guy is completely the other side of that, which I'll get to it. But I'll introduce the author first. Adam Hall's real name is Elliston Trevor. He was a British writer who wrote under a very large number of pseudonyms. But he wrote the Quiller series of books, of which Tango Briefing is number 5 of 19.
Gosh.
All of which are they're sort of variable, but this one, to me, is the peak of the whole lot. They're all very good. Some people might remember the Quiller series from the film The Quiller Memorandum, which was filmed in the 1960s with George Segal in the lead role, and Robert Heltman as one of the intelligence agents. Very strange, set in Berlin, but gave you a pretty good idea of the type of thing that Adam Hall was doing with these particular books. Now, Elliston Trevor's probably best known to most people as the author or the screenwriter for the film Flight of the Phoenix, which was filmed in the mid-60s with James Stewart, Richard Attenborough, Peter Finch. I think August Borgnine's in it as well. It's a fantastic film. That concerns a plane that crash lands in the northern African Saharan desert. As it happens, so does this book. But it's not in... this is in sort of more Algeria, Morocco, I think. So basically what's happened is that the main character here, Quiller, and that's all we know of him as, that's what his code name is, you sort of get the impression that that is not his original name, and you never learn his original name at all. All he's done is he's just referred to as Q or Quiller. So he is an executive working for the Bureau, which is a ultra-secret section of the intelligence services, answerable only to the Prime Minister. They are sent in as individuals to go in and fix up problems, either to get somebody across a border, because don't forget these were written at the time massively in the middle of the Cold War, so it's mostly Cold War-related material we're talking about here. This one's 1973. Either has to get documents from somebody and bring them across a border so that nobody finds them, because at that time there was no way of being able to get them electronically across. You had to bring the physical documents across. Or to get somebody across a border at some point. Think The Spy That Came In From the Cold, the very first scene of that where Lohmann is waiting for somebody to come across from East Germany into West Germany at Checkpoint Charlie. That sort of same sort of stuff. Now, Quiller, as I said, is sort of the antithesis of James Bond. He never carries a gun. In fact, goes out of his way in most of the books, or the author does in most of the books, to give an explanation as to why. When Quiller is standing there and a guy 2 or 3 metres away is pointing a gun at him, that Quiller is in the prime spot. He has more control over the situation than the guy holding the gun has. Now, normally you and I would sit there going, oh, come on. But Adam Hall's writes so beautifully and so well that he actually convinces you that, yes, he actually does have control over this, because the guy with the gun is overly confident about what he can do, because he thinks this is the guy with the gun, that he's in control. And because of that, he's not as keyed up to everything as he should be. Now, Quiller basically, in this instance, is flown into North Africa because he has to try and find out what has happened to a British aircraft that has crashed in the desert in North Africa. The British authorities are not, well, they sort of know, think they know what's on this particular plane, but they're not telling Quiller what it is. He just has to go in there. And as he gets to the town nearest to where he has to go, he has a control, a person that is there to do all the communications and logistics around the outside of the work that he has to do. But Quiller has to do basically everything on his own, and he has to run flat out. He doesn't really know how to get to where he needs to get to. He's got to figure this out as he goes. So all of this stuff is done on the seat of his pants. Anyway, he's basically got to he's got to figure it all out as he goes and work out from where he is to where he's got to get to. Sometimes he gets dropped into a target zone, and he has even no idea what the mission is. He's just said something's going on. Go in and find out what it is. So in those instances, what he does is he sets himself up as a target for the other intelligence agencies to have a shot at him. And therefore, then he works out what it is, and he turns the tables, follows them, and gets in. In this instance, he knows where he has to go, but he's got to work out how to get there, which he does. He parachutes in, he finds the plane, and he finds out that what's happened is that the plane has been transporting a very noxious nerve gas, which has been produced in Britain and aimed to be sold to an African country, but has crash-landed in a sandstorm in the Algerian desert. He gets that information under a lot of duress from a couple of other intelligence agencies that don't know what's going on, but know that because he's there, something's happening. And so he just carries on and has to keep on going right through to the very end, where he has to try and work out a way of being able to destroy the plane without destroying himself. Generally, when you get one of those, when Adam Hall does one of these sort of almost puzzle pieces at the very end, all the time he's very ingenious about how he solves it, and it comes out very, very well. Now, most of the time, Quiller is thrown into really harsh environments. He always has to go to the desert in the middle of summer. He always has to go to Eastern Europe in the middle of winter, or he gets thrown into somewhere like Bangkok in the middle of a monsoon after he's just come out of Poland out of the middle of winter. And so he's basically jumped around all over the place. You get the impression that, you know, he's probably too good to be true.
Yes.
But it's just done so incredibly well. You can pretty much guarantee that there's great tradecraft in this. He explains to you how you go about losing a car that's chasing you and what you have to do to get around it. But you've got to basically ride out there on the very edge and be able to play chicken right to the point of death, basically. But you can pretty much guarantee there's going to be one massively big explosion and one car chase. Oddly enough, all the time, whenever he's away on a mission, when he comes back, he has to justify his expenses. So he's being hammered by this bureaucracy at home, and he talks about the old maid sitting there at accounts going over every single pence that he spent that he has to account for. He's got to keep the receipts. And so this stuff is just fantastic. And this
sounds good.
Of the 19 that he wrote, I think the Tango Briefing is the absolute best of the lot. There was, at one point, a TV series in the 70s, I think, British TV series called about Quiller. I never got to see it. I don't think it's available, or maybe very difficult to find. And at one point, the Tango Briefing was muted to be made into a film with, of all people, John Travolta in the lead role.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely the wrong person. Now, the best people that could have done, they've got to be British to be able to do this, because this is a very, very British public service oriented executive intelligence stuff. The best people that would have been might have been, say, Clive Owen a few years back, but he's now too old. I'm not sure who could play it now, but it has to be somebody British. You could not have an American playing this role. It just wouldn't make any sense. Now, this is, people are going, that's really weird. Why has he picked this as a favourite? It's just a favourite. My mother, back in the 60s, got me onto these because she really loved them. My father loves them. And these are just absolutely wonderful British intelligence.
Yeah, I must look them up.
Novels. They are fantastic stuff.
Well, I haven't read any of this, but I will look them up. All right. Well, these are going to work together quite well in terms of pairing, Perry, because if you're talking about a character who is almost too good to be true, then this certainly would be true of the books. In fact, the books I'm going to be talking about. So this is what is generally called the Lyman Saga by Dorothy Dunnett. Again, it's not a single book. It's a series of six books, beginning with The Game of Kings, which was published in 1961. So it's historical fiction, but accurate historical fiction. The series begins in Scotland in the mid-1540s. At that stage, Mary, Queen of Scots, is a child, and the English are making incursions into Scotland to try and capture her in order to marry her off to young King Edward, the son of Henry VIII, who was recently deceased. Against this background, the books deal with the life and adventures of one Francis Crawford, who was often called by the name of his manor of Lymond. This was often the way in those days people get called by the name of the region that they came from, or the property they owned. So he's often called Lymond. His elder brother Richard has inherited the title of Baron Coulter. And as the first book opens, Lymond is an outlaw. He was captured as a teenager at the Battle of Solway Moss and taken as a prisoner to England and kept there for some time. And he's been accused while there of becoming a traitor, turning his coat and to have been subsequently working for the English against the interests of the Scots. And he has in fact been accused of terrible crimes, including blowing up a nunnery and killing all the nuns there, of whom his sister Eloise was one. As the book opens, in fact, we've got no reason to doubt any of this about Francis Crawford. Indeed, one of the very first scenes in the book is where Lymond invades his family's castle, robs it, and sets it on fire while his mother and her friends are inside. Fortunately, not much damage is done and the ladies are uninjured. So right from the start, we're primed to see Lymond as a villain, but he's an extraordinary character with many complex facets. And we slowly begin to find out that he's been accused falsely and he's trying to clear his name while he's living this very wild life as an outlaw with a band of his followers. But his brother Richard believes all of the accusations up against Francis, and he's determined to track him down and see him face justice. So there's this tension between them throughout the whole book. Lyman is someone who attracts strong passions in those he comes into contact with. On one hand, he can inspire love and fierce loyalty. On the other, he can inspire bitter enmity and hatred. And for much of the time, he also seems to be his own worst enemy. He kind of risks his life unnecessarily, suffers a great deal, and is driven by some sort of buried torment, which we only very slowly come to understand throughout the course of these books. And it's the fascination with the character of Francis Crawford which drives these books. But the historical period that they're set in is itself absorbing. It's all based on what seems to be very solid historical research. I mean, you can check up on all this stuff pretty readily. There are some parts of the books which you assume at the start must be made up. Just seems so unlikely and extraordinary. But it turns out that most of these passages are in fact actual solid historical fact. One example would be the several attempts to assassinate Mary, Queen of Scots, during her childhood, while she's living in France for a while. And that's in the second book of the series, Queen's Play. And of course, Lymond comes to the rescue of Mary while he's in deep cover, in disguise. But the books really take off with the third one in the series, which is called The Disorderly Knights, which deal largely with the Knights Hospitaller of St. John, which is a crusading order based in Malta. And Lyman is there on Malta when the Ottoman Turks lay siege to the island and helps to defend it. And there he meets with and is intrigued by a saintly character of, this is Sir Graham Mallet, who's called Gabriel by his admirers, who really think he's a saint. Spoiler warning, Gabriel is not what he seems and becomes Lyman's bitter enemy and antagonist in this and the following novel, Pawn and Frankincense. So the further books take Lyman to Turkey and the court of Suleiman the Magnificent, and from there to Russia, where Lyman becomes the most trusted general of Ivan the Terrible, and then back to France again, where Mary Queen of Scots is about to marry the Dauphin. And for services to the French king at that stage, Lyman is awarded the title of Comte de Sévigné, and so from then on he's called Sévigné rather than Lyman. But anyway, we'll keep calling him Lyman. Throughout these books, which cover a period of some 12 years or so, we also follow the character of a young girl, Philippa Somerville. And in the very first book, Game of Kings, Lyman forces entry into Philippa's family's home, which is in Hexham on the border of Scotland and England. And he interrogates her father because he's trying to clear his name of these accusations. And so he interrogates the father, but he can't be certain of that Somerville, the father, is telling the truth. And so he forces young Philippa, who was then only a child of 8 or 9, to answer his questions about her father's movements, to, you know, it's like double check them. And it terrifies her and makes her hate Lyman. We can encounter her again in the book The Disorderly Knights. And as she grows to adulthood through the course of these books, we follow her character and experiences. And this includes her stowing away at one point to follow Lyman to Turkey when she's in her early adolescence. She doesn't do this because she's enamored of Lyman. In fact, she still hates him. But to help Lyman rescue a child, which is too complex to explain the plot at this stage. And in the fifth book, The Ring Castle, after she's been in Turkey, the fifth book, The Ring Castle, begins with this memorable phrase, which I always remember. So it's a quote, "Not to every young girl is it given to enter the harem of the Sultan of Turkey and return to her homeland a virgin." Which I think is one of the best first lines of any book I've ever read. Needless to say, her relationship with Lyman changes over time, becomes very complex indeed. It's not any sort of obvious transition. And eventually comes to a shattering climax in the final book, Checkmate. All of these books have got titles inspired by the game of chess, as you can probably track of it as I've been mentioning them. But we shouldn't forget that Checkmate means literally the king is dead. But don't take any spoilers from that. I mean, you may be wrong. Anyway, it's wonderful stuff, and I'm itching to read all of these books again. Friends of mine, for a while, were rereading this series once every year. I don't think I could quite do that, but once every decade for certain. Good stuff.
Once a year would strike me as being, you know, a bit tough. How many books in the series?
6.
Yeah,
they're doable. Pretty thick books.
Yeah, doable, but I think after a while you probably get the point. You think, I don't really need a break from these. Problems about rereading your favourite books too often is they become too familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're no longer they no longer give you that feeling of surprise in terms of, I'd forgotten about that. And that was one thing my father has said to me about getting old. And he said, he's been losing his memory a bit. But he said that at one point. The good thing about it is that I can go back and read books like June if I'd never read them before. Now, well, you and I, hopefully, David, are at that age where that isn't the case that we would
not
do.
Not yet.
But you still want to be able to read your favourite books again and get something out of them that you didn't get the first time.
Oh, that's for sure.
And out of each of those three that I've spoken about there, I got things out of them that I'd forgotten about or had completely just ignored, didn't notice. Mm. And you get them the second, third, fourth, fifth time around. But I wouldn't want to do it every year. And one of the ones I get to at the end, I think I've read the last book, I think I've read about, this is probably about the fourth time, and I read it about every decade. And I reckon if I read it more often than that, it might fade a bit. That isn't the next one I'm talking about. That one's, I'm back to nonfiction again.
All right.
And this time, it's a book that we have mentioned on this podcast previously, and I'll give the reasons why in a minute. This book is Guns, Germs and Steel by Jared Diamond from 1997. This is a transdisciplinary book, as it's referred to. What this basically means is that Diamond has written a book and he has utilized research in the fields of history, botany, literature, science, biology, geography, chemistry, blah, blah, on and on and on. All anthropology, he's brought a whole lot of stuff into this one particular theory that he's got. It's probably best to sum it up by the way that Wikipedia gives it, and I'll read this the way that they've put it in. The book attempts to explain why Eurasian and North African civilizations have survived and conquered others, while arguing against the idea that Eurasian hegemony is due to any form of Eurasian intellectual, moral, or inherent genetic superiority. Now, if you take that back to the beginning, what it basically says is that we all started exactly the same way. We're all out of Africa, if you like, if that's the theory. We're all out of Africa, all on a level playing field. But why then did we have the Renaissance in Europe, but not a similar thing in either
North Africa or Australia? Why did that happen? The major reason why Jared Diamond decided that he needed to write this book was that he was doing some work in New Guinea way back in the 1970s. And he was walking along a beach with a New Guinean politician. And that politician said to him, "Why is it that you white people develop so much cargo, that is stuff, products and stuff, and brought it to New Guinea, but we black people had little cargo of our own? How did that happen?" And that got him to thinking about why European countries ended up getting the where they did and others didn't. Now, a lot of what he comes down to deals with what was available in the environment at the time that the civilization started up. So all of that golden arc all the way through from Greece, Turkey, down through to Levant, I think it's called, down through Syria, Israel, all of that, where they had the three or four big major cereal crops of wheat, barley and oats, which were very high in carbohydrates and protein and vitamins, and were very easily susceptible to cultivation and harvesting. And because of that, they were able to be developed and people were able to stop moving around chasing game and sit in one place. And when you have people that are sitting in one place, you then are able to specialise people to do particular things. So you have one person that decides, well, I wonder what happens if I stick this. Well, finds out that, you know, to stick a rock in a that's been sitting in a fire and it comes out and looks funny. And then you get metallurgy coming up. And then you get a whole lot of things expanding from that because people aren't having to move continuously. They can sit and work on things and build things up. This is a fairly monumental piece of work. It won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction when it was written. It's been followed up by a couple of other books that are sort of similar in that sequence, called Collapse from 2005 and Upheaval in 2019. And as it happens, I'm currently reading Upheaval as well. Collapse deals with why did certain civilizations just come apart? Why did the Viking colony in Greenland just stop? Why did the... there was a very large...
the Mayans.
Yeah, the Mayans. Why did the... American Plains Indians in the south of southern parts of America, they had a very large civilization that just disappeared. And most of it comes down to the fact that it was environmental collapse. What happened to East Island? They just all died out. What happened? Why did it stop? So he goes through to all of those things in Collapse. But his whole idea in Gums, Germs, and Steel is sort of deciding what made one set of nations able to achieve things that others didn't achieve. Now, he's not saying that because they got a Renaissance and were able to come up with the Mona Lisa on one side and you had rock drawings on another, that one's different to the one, one's better than the other. He's just saying, how do they get down this path or that path? What was that caused by? And his whole point here is to try to come up with a reason that is completely away from, as this comment says, intellectual, moral, or inherent genetic superiority. There isn't any of that here at all. And he comes to this from a very well-informed space and it's an excellent book to read. Now, he makes some points about the Australian Indigenous population, which you, David, had said in that Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe, he actually mentions Jared Diamond's work here and says that no, Diamond's probably got
He
it
was
wrong.
wrong.
Yeah. So,
He was certainly wrong in that aspect. That was about them collecting grains and things.
yeah.
But I think the rest of his thesis holds up pretty well.
I think it basically comes to is, yeah, there were grains. He does actually mention there were grains in Australia, but the calorific content or quality of them was nowhere near as high as it was in Turkey and Syria and Israel around that area. And so those particular grains, which also adapted to being genetically modified by breeding, selective breeding by the harvesters and the farmers, made it a heck of a lot better. And I think that made it worked. It worked well for him. So a favorite book. I found it an astounding book in the sense of the amount of work that had gone into it, a lifetime's work gone into this particular, coming up to an answer for this particular one question, and that he was able to deliver it in such a flowing style that didn't drown you in academic jargon or style. Which is a bit of a problem with the Joseph Campbell, but not a problem here. I found this read beautifully. I thought it was excellent.
That's good. That's good. All right. Well, I've also got a non-fiction book to talk about, which is one of my favorite books, again, which I've read several times and would look forward to reading again. And this one's called The Path Between the Seas by Dave McCulloch. David McCulloch is a very prolific American writer of history who's won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Harry Truman, and he's written a number of other biographies of American presidents, as well as more general historical works like this one. So this one is my favorite of all his books that he's written. It's all about the building of the Panama Canal between the years of 1870 and 1914. And why is it so good? Well, it's simply an amazing true story. It's full of larger-than-life characters, scandal, political intrigue, huge engineering challenges, medical breakthroughs, life and death on a grand scale. It's got more drama and more interest than most novels. It's a long book. It's 617 pages in my paperback edition in fairly small type, and that's not including the notes. But as I've read it several times and would like to read it again. So let me summarize the plot. Yeah, I know it's non-fiction, but look, it reads almost like a novel. So let's indulge ourselves and discuss it that way for a minute. Well, the villain, if it can be said to be one, is the hostile landscape of Panama. And the story is one of hubris among humans and a struggle against fate. It begins with a vision, the vision of creating a means for ships to pass from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific without the need to make the hazardous journey around the tip of South America, which was the only way to do it, of course, in those days. So for obvious reasons, the Americans were very interested in such an idea at an early stage. And in 1870, they sent expeditions both to Panama, to the Panama Isthmus, and to Nicaragua. Indeed, an American commission set up by President Ulysses Grant unanimously agreed that the path should go through Nicaragua, which had far, far more tractable terrain than Panama. It was a bigger distance, but it was much easier to work with in that area. So that was where the canal was going to go. But here's where one of those larger-than-life figures comes upon the scene in the form of Ferdinand de Lesseps, who was the Frenchman who had successfully organized the building of the Suez Canal during the 1860s. To great acclaim, he was considered to be a hero in France. De Lesseps, however, wasn't any kind of engineer. He was originally just a diplomat, but he seems like he had a passion and a gift of being able to stir up passion in others and the ability to marshal funds and resources and get things done. So, with the success of the Suez behind him, this hero of France joined a French syndicate dedicated to building a canal across the Isthmus of Panama. It's hard to say that word, Isthmus. Anyway, de Lesseps, without having seen the terrain, declared that the canal must be built at sea level with no locks required, just like at Suez. And so that's what the Syndicate set out to do. The fact is, however, that such an approach was doomed to failure. And after 4 years of effort and the spending of millions of francs and huge loss of life, in 1885, the French Syndicate went bust and all construction stopped. Many influential figures in France, such as Gustave Eiffel, the building of the Eiffel Tower, were involved in the Syndicate. And the loss of the savings of tens of thousands of French investors in the Syndicate was a major blow. And it was clear that apart from the engineering problems, there'd been suspect financial dealings as well. And so there was a huge scandal, which apparently rocked France to the core. It's all detailed in this book. Now, the Americans, after this had gone on, the Americans decided to come back into the game because this canal had already been started, at least. And so we have yet another larger-than-life figure, President Theodore Roosevelt, who decided to take over from where the French had left off. Now, de Lesseps' idea of a sea-level canal was abandoned because it was totally impractical. But there were still, nevertheless, huge problems, both from an engineering standpoint and also from the problems of working in a tropical area like this one. Malaria and yellow fever were endemic to the area and were killing thousands of workers and their supervisors. This had been a major problem for the French, and it was certainly the same for the Americans. Now, at that stage, no one knew how these diseases spread. The word malaria simply means bad air in Italian, because it was thought that unhealthy air and smells, bad smells, were to blame. And so we come to yet another major character in this book, a man called Colonel William Gorgas, who was an army doctor, who became convinced that mosquitoes were the carriers of these diseases, and therefore the diseases could be defeated by controlling the breeding of the insects. Now, this time, there was very considerable skepticism and even ridicule about these ideas. But Gorgas forcefully pushed for them to be put into practice with a great deal of success. He did things like, for example, in hospitals at the time in these tropical areas, the feet of hospital beds were put in little pots of water to stop ants climbing up into the bed. But of course, these little pots of water are perfect breeding grounds for mosquitoes. So he eliminated that, had oil spread on any open stretch of water, still stretch of water, to stop the mosquitoes breeding. And it was very, very successful. And without that, the canal could never have been built. And then there was the little problem that Panama was, at that stage, part of the nation of Colombia. Which country wanted to impose conditions on the use of the canal that the Americans didn't like? So what did they do? Well, to that end, the Americans fomented a revolution, as you do, and supported the breakaway of the Panama region into an independent nation, which, of course, was then under the thumb of the Americans. So, as I say, this book's got everything. High drama, scandal, engineering, medicine, politics. I love it. It's a great book.
Yep. Okay. So for my last book, piece of fiction, probably my favourite novel of all time, is The French Lieutenant's Woman, or French Lieutenant's Woman, by John Fowles from 1969. Now, I've no idea why I ever picked this book up to read. I can only think that maybe there was somebody in fandom, John Bankson or somebody, who may have mentioned it, and I thought, well, I better read this because other people are saying how good it is. Because it's not a book that I would have ever have thought I would have gone anywhere near in the first instance. It's a Victorian romance, or a failed love affair, or is it a failed love affair? We'll get to that. Written in a very modern style. So it's written in 1969, but the book is set in the 1860s, so exactly 100 years previously. The main character of the book is a gentleman by the name of Charles Smithson, who is heir to a title through his uncle, and is very well off. He's a Victorian gentleman who is very interested in paleontology, follower of Darwin, believes in the theory of evolution. He thinks it's the correct explanation for how humans evolved on the planet and everything else evolved on the planet. He and his fiancée, Ernestina, are in Lyme Regis, where they have gone down to visit her aunt, and Charles has taken the opportunity to hunt for fossils down on the shore because there's a lot of fossils down there. Now, they go for a walk, Charles and Ernestina one afternoon or one evening, and they have pointed out to her them a woman who was standing on the cob at Lyme Regis. Now, the cob is sort of like a stone pier that curves out from the shore that allows, it sort of acts like a bit of a sea break so that the waves don't wash into the shore and wreck all the boats that are in there, but also allows for larger boats to be able to pull in to be able to offload as well. She is standing at the edge of the pier staring out to sea. Now, she's referred to by some people as the French lieutenant's whore on the basis that she had an affair with this French lieutenant who left her and abandoned her. And she's standing there staring out to sea, waiting for him to come back. Or is she? The first time that Charles and Ernestina meet up with this woman is actually in the very first chapter. At the end of the second chapter. And I'll read what Fowles has to say. It's a longish quote, but it basically says everything to me about this particular book and the reason why I ended up reading it. She turned to look at him. The she here is the French lieutenant's woman. Or as it seemed to Charles, through him. It was not so much what was positively in that face which remained with him after that first meeting, but all that was not as he had expected. For theirs was an age when the favoured feminine look was the demure, the obedient, the shy. Charles felt immediately as if he had trespassed, as if the cob belonged to that face and not to the ancient borough of Lyme. It was not a pretty face, like Ernestina's. It was certainly not a beautiful face by any period standard or taste, but it was an unforgettable face and a tragic face. Its sorrow welled out of it as purely, naturally and unstoppably as water out of a woodland spring. There was no artifice there, no hypocrisy, no hysteria, no mask, and above all, no sign of madness. The madness was in the empty sea, the empty horizon, the lack of reason for such sorrow, as if the spring was natural in itself, but unnatural in welling from a desert.
Mm.
As soon as I read that, I go, I'm in with this guy. He can turn a sentence, he's fantastic. And then it's basically the ensuing relationship that builds up between Charles and Sarah Woodruff, the French lieutenant's woman. Charles doesn't want this relationship. He's fully committed to Ernestina, his fiancée, but it just gets fixated on this particular woman and can't. He tries to save her. Wrong thing to do, Charles. Shouldn't have done that. Then he basically tries to leave her and get rid of her. Can't do that either. Then he tries to have her and he can't do that. And the whole thing is just beautifully written from a modern perspective, looking back on it. And some of it's just funny. Fowles just put some really funny comments in. And I can remember the first time reading this book, and I'm getting along, and I thought, oh, there's one particular scene. I think, oh, I wonder what's going on with that. Don't understand that one. And later on, Charles is taking a train's journey, and there's a guy standing on the platform of this train station who gets onto the train, onto the same carriage as Charles. Charles doesn't like him being in the carriage because Charles wanted the whole carriage to himself so he could just wallow in his sadness. And he stares at the floor, and this other character in the train station, in the train carriage, stares at Charles. And after a while, you realise it's the author. John Fowles has put himself into his own book 100 years previously. Whether he put himself in there because he didn't know what to do with Charles at that time and he was trying to figure it out, or whether he was just because he wanted to do it as a technique, but he mentally tosses a coin at the end of that chapter and decides that Charles could go one way or the other. The story could go one way or the other. And as it happens, Fowles gives you three different endings to this book. One is the standard, oh, yeah, everything's all right. Charles gets rid of Sarah. One of them is the one where obviously Fowles thinks is the correct one that happens, where they drift apart and then find each other again a year or two later. And the other one is the bitter one, where everything goes wrong. and half the people decide to kill each other, kill themselves, I think. It's a fantastic book. It really is. There are just such wonderful things in this. You've got probably the only book that I could think of that is similar in the sort of style and the approach. Well, not so much the approach in this instance, but the I can see similarities between this and Possession by A.S. Byatt that we spoke about sometime earlier on this podcast. But this is an absolute cracker of a book. About 400 pages. You may think that a Victorian romance is going to be absolutely terrible, but it's just stunning. It is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's referred to as a... Well, I've got to get this right. His historiographic metafiction, which combines literary devices of metafiction and historical fiction. In other words, the idea of him putting himself into the book and having three separate endings is a sort of metafictional style of being able to do things. This introduced me to modern fiction, and it sort of said, this is what's possible. This is what you can do if you know what the hell you're doing, but you better know what you're doing. Fowles does know, or did know, what he was doing with this particular book, and pulls it off magnificently. I read this about every decade. This is one book I will go back to, and I'll probably got another two more readings of it over my lifetime. After I've just read it about a month ago, I'm actually looking forward to reading it again in 10 years' time. I can't say anything more than that. This is my all-time favourite.
It's certainly a good book. There was a not bad movie made of it with Jeremy Irons and Meryl Streep.
I've never watched it. I remember
they took an interesting approach, which was to actually contrast a modern-day couple, which was still played by Jeremy Irons and Meryl Streep, with the historical couple. And so there was this kind of reflection back on the Victorian times from a 20th century standpoint. So it was interesting.
No, I can remember once the science fiction fan writer and editor Terry Carr saying that his favourite book was Alice in Wonderland. And he had never, ever seen a film version of it.
No.
Because, as he said, the problem was if you see somebody else's version of this book, it'll ruin your own.
They can do whatever they liked to
make a film with this. I'm never going to go and see it. The film you're talking about had Jeremy Irons and Meryl Streep in the lead roles.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Yep.
Probably the choice that I would have made at the time, but I'm never, ever going to go and see it.
Fair enough. You don't want to spoil the book. That's fair enough.
Yep.
All right, hopefully we'll be winding up soon. We've been going for quite some time. This is my last book anyway, and this also is probably my favourite book of all time too, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. Now, this is a massive slab of a book. It's I've got the hardcover. In fact, this, just to give an indication of it being my favourite book, I not only own the hardcover, I also own the ebook, and I also own the audiobook, all three versions. Anyway, this plus the TV series, which I might mention briefly. So a massive type of a book. It's 782 pages in hardback. Apparently, it's more than 320,000 words, although I haven't counted them. But I've read it more than once, and I'd love to find the time to go back and read it yet again. It's simply the best novel of fantasy ever written, as far as I'm concerned. It deservedly won the 2005 Hugo Award for Best Novel, and yet it was a debut novel for its author, Susanna Clarke. The book just seemed to come out of nowhere. It apparently took her 10 years to write, and we're still waiting for her next book, so it's she always takes her time. So Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is set in an alternative England at the time of the Napoleonic Wars. The book opens in the year 1806. Most of the history of England seems to be the same as in our own timeline. At that stage in history, the country's at war with France. The Prince Regent's the ruler, and his father, George III, is gone crazy. He's in madness. But right from the start, we know something is different. And I will actually quote the start of the book because I think it's kind of lovely. So here's the start of the book. Some years ago, there was in the city of York a society of magicians. They met upon the third Wednesday of every month and read each other long, dull papers upon the history of English magic. They were gentlemen magicians, which is to say, they had never harmed anyone by magic, nor ever done anyone the slightest good. In fact, to own the truth, not one of these magicians had ever cast the smallest spell, nor by magic caused one leaf to tremble upon a tree, made one mote of dust to alter its course, or changed a single hair upon anyone's head. But with this one minor reservation, they enjoyed a reputation as some of the wisest and most magical gentlemen in Yorkshire. I think it's just a beautiful bit of writing. It's a lovely start. But at one of these meetings of this society, a new member comes along. He's been for a couple of meetings so far, but he's got the courage up to speak, finally. He's a gentleman called John Segundus, and he poses an awkward question. Why is no more magic done in England? And the other men present ridicule him. And again, I'm quoting. You would not, I imagine, suggest that it is the task of botanists to devise more flowers? Or that astronomers should labour to rearrange the stars? Magicians, Mr. Segundus, study magic which was done long ago. Why should anyone expect more? But so he's very disappointed. But outside the meeting, he finds a sympathiser in a gentleman called Mr. Honeyfoot. And Segundus persists, and he finally tracks down someone who's been buying up ancient books discussing magic. And this turns out to be a very reclusive individual, Gilbert Norrell, who they discover owns a vast library of rare magic books, which he shows them. And what's more, he professes to be able to perform magic. So they come back and they tell the society this, and the society challenges Norrell to demonstrate. And so he does. He actually puts on an astonishing demonstration inside York Minster, which is the cathedral in Yorkshire, in York. So we begin to pick on the history of magic in England. We learn that many centuries ago, the north of England was ruled by someone called the Raven King, John Usglas, a powerful magician who was traditionally, this is a quote, who was traditionally held to have possessed three kingdoms, one in England, one in Faerie, and one in a strange country on the far side of hell. A little later we come across Jonathan Strange, who's a gentleman's son who's looking for a profession. And he's looking at the idea of going to the army or into the clergy. But he's out riding one day and he's accosted by a strange individual called Vinculus, who tells him that a prophecy says that he's born to be a magician. So he's intrigued by this and he begins to study up on the subject as best he can, although the books are pretty rare to get hold of. But he knows nothing of Mr. Norrell at this stage until he encounters John Segundus and Honeyfoot. Much later, he ends up becoming Norrell's pupil for a period before their mutual jealousy turns into a bitter rivalry. But that's getting ahead of the story. Norrell moves to London at the urging of his pragmatic and ambitious, very dour chap called servant of Norrell called Childemas, to try and put his magical knowledge to use in the current war with Napoleon, which isn't going very well. Now, Norrell's initially scorned by the authorities and has no success at all until he's put in a position to help the cabinet minister, Sir Walter Pole, whose fiancée is dying. Now, her death would deprive Sir Walter Pole of her fortune, which he'd been depending. Indeed, she actually does die. But Norrell is able to bring her back using magic. To do so, however, he must enter into a pact with a powerful fairy, whose name, true name we never learn, but who's throughout the book simply called the Gentleman with the Thistledown Hair. These fairies, you must understand, are most emphatically not the pretty ones with butterfly wings. Indeed, they're mostly inimical to humans and have evil intent. And that, we discover, is certainly true of the Gentleman with the Thistledown Hair. It's impossible to summarise the huge book. But what appeals to me is the utter richness and depth of the book. It's full of detailed footnotes spelling out the invented legends and the history of human encounters with the fairy world, every one of which you should read. You should read all the footnotes. There's so much detail that the reader, like myself, starts to believe that this is true knowledge, a true history of England, just seen behind a veil. It's an astonishing creative feat, which I think is on a par with the creation in the book Possession, which we've talked about several times on the podcast, where the author creates these reams of unique poetry in two completely different styles. Well, it's like that. She seems to be inventing this massive history of magic in England, and the detail is just astonishing. And it's beautifully written. It's full of great characters, not just Norrell and Strange, but Lady Pole, whose resurrection from the dead does not go well, Strange's wife Arabella, Norrell's servant Childermas, who's a very interesting character, the street magician Vinculus, Stephen Black, the Negro servant of Sir Walter, who gets very much involved with the gentleman with thistle-down hair, and not to mention, of course, that gentleman himself, and also John Usglas, the Raven King himself. I can't praise this book highly enough. If you ask me what my favourite book is of all time in any genre, at the moment it would definitely be this one, even though I dislike most fantasy.
I believe that when it came out, Neil Gaiman said that it was the best fantasy novel that had been written in the past 50 years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think he was very careful about his timing for that, because the 50 years would have taken it 2005 back to 1955, 55. So probably would have got to the point where it was post-Tolkien. Mm-hmm. So he was basically trying to make sure that he didn't put the Tolkien people offside. But
even so, if I had to weigh in one hand The Lord of the Rings and this book on the other, I'd still go for Jonathan Strange.
Fair enough, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway. I can understand it. It's one that is up on the shelf that is staring at me, and I'm going to have to get to it at some point.
It's very rewarding, but take your time with it. It's a long book. Yeah. All right, well, we've been going for a very long time. We should wind up.
Just before we go, I thought that what I would do is I made a list, because it's always difficult coming up with
top five. Oh, you had a list of another possible five.
I basically sat down first thing this morning and thought, and I'd been thinking about this over the last couple of weeks while we've been working out what books to do. And I decided that what I would do is I'd add some honourable mentions in, ones that, could really have spoken about but didn't quite make it. And you'll catch some of these things. And the first two in particular, Flaubert's Parrot by Julian Barnes and Yvonne Witter's Night of Traveller by Italo Calvino.
Uh-huh.
I reckon I probably would not have picked up and read and enjoyed as much unless I had read French Lieutenant's Woman first. So there's that. Shogun by James Clavell.
Okay.
My father, who's been a science fiction reader since the 1940s, says that he believes that this is the best First Contact book ever written.
Mm-hmm.
So he looks at it as almost being science fiction.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
And it's a very interesting point, which I've never discussed with anybody, and I really should. The other two that I've got here for the five honourable mentions are The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin. I mentioned that when I was talking about Left Hand of Darkness. And the other one is the Earthsea series by Ursula K. Le Guin. You picked up a series, and I thought I'd do that.
Yeah.
I think there's one that I'm a little bit ambivalent about, but there's about six in the series, and it's a cracker. Another YA series, which is just really, really good. And people should just read it and be done with it.
Sure.
And just don't. The whole point about these things is you shouldn't put labels on them to say, oh, this isn't good enough, I'm not going to read this. Just read the thing. If somebody says they think it's a good book, I mean, you can get an absolutely utterly fantastic Western. I don't care. If it's a really, really good Western, who cares?
I can name one, actually. Mary Doria Russell, is it, who wrote
Sparrow?
Her book about Doc Holliday is great. It's a Western. What's it called? Doc. This thing's just called Doc. And that's terrific.
One of my favourite all-time films is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Sure.
And that's a Western. It's just a straight-out Western.
Sure.
And it's just fantastic. Yeah. There's no problem about reading across any genres, and I think that that's the one thing that I think we're trying to get across on this particular podcast is our love of all books across all the different varieties, and it just works.
All right. Well, I'm just going to very quickly give you my alternative best five. Possession, which we talked about so many times. Historical fiction, The Wolf Hall trilogy, which I've just finished, which is terrific, by Hilary Mantel. Non-fiction, Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin, which is about Lincoln and setting up his cabinet once he was elected. Collections, the collected fiction of, I've got to get this right, Jorge Luis Borges, Yeah, is that how you pronounce, would pronounce it, you think? I've tried hard with that.
Borges. Borges? Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And in science fiction, the Expanse series, that would be my other choice for the science fiction category.
Yep. Okay, that seems fair. Yep. I think we're done, David.
No, I think we're definitely done.
I think we're definitely done. I think we've covered a heck of a lot of material here. Probably enough for about three episodes. We're trying to ram it all into one. But that's okay. But thanks very much. Thanks very much for the last year. It's been
thank
really
you too.
Excellent.
It's been fun. Yeah.
We're still going to be carrying on. This isn't a farewell episode.
No.
We've got lots more things that we need to talk about,
yes.
David.
Indeed.
Things coming up. We'll be talking science fiction television, science fiction film. We'll be talking alternate histories.
Mm.
We'll be talking crime.
Yeah.
We'll be talking everything. Everything that we can think of.
Indeed, indeed.
So look forward to it.
Indeed. So we'll see you next week. And then next fortnight. Keep saying next week.
Thank you very much, David.
Okay. Thanks.
Talk
Thanks,
to you
Barry.
Then.
Catch you then. Okay.
Right.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.